Good morning. The Supreme Court has delivered its final rulings of the term on its most closely watched cases.
Also, the Washington Post unpacks one of Trump's big wins at the court this week, giving him expansive new powers over the federal bureaucracy. And the historical reenactors on the front lines of America's 250th birthday celebration.
It's Tuesday, June 30th. I'm Cecilia Lay.
And I'm Gideon Resnick. And this is Apple News Today.
Birthright citizenship has been upheld. This is the 157-year-old landmark law that allows virtually anyone born in the United States American citizenship. In a 6-3 decision, the court ruled that President Trump's attempt to end birthright citizenship is unconstitutional. He signed an executive order on the first day of his second term to support his immigration agenda. The order directed federal agencies to deny citizenship to children born in the U.S. whose parents are not American citizens or legal permanent residents. Trump has incorrectly and repeatedly claimed the U.S. is an outlier by granting automatic birthright citizenship.
It's ridiculous. We're the only country in the world that does this with birthright, as you know. And it's just absolutely ridiculous. But, you know, we'll see.
That statement is not true. 32 other countries have birthright citizenship policies that are substantially similar, according to the Pew Research Center. In the U.S., birthright was established after the Civil War by the 14th Amendment to grant citizenship to formerly enslaved people and their children. And the Supreme Court ruled in 1898 that the law applied to all people born in the U.S., even if their parents are not citizens, with very few exceptions. But the Trump administration has argued the amendment has been interpreted too broadly and applied to too many people.
Hundreds of thousands of people are pouring into our country under birthright citizenship, and it wasn't meant for that reason. It was meant for the babies of slaves.
But lower courts and the U.S. Supreme Court have all now upheld the broad understanding of birthright citizenship that's been in place for over a century. And in his majority opinion, Chief Justice Roberts noted that the 14th Amendment was written to define citizenship in broad terms on purpose. The decision will shape immigration policy for generations. In another highly anticipated ruling, the court says states can prevent transgender women and girls from playing on women's and girls' sports teams. This was a 6-3 ruling along ideological lines. There were two legal challenges to state laws involved in this ruling. A young trans woman wanted to try out for the Boise State University women's track and field team in Idaho, a state that bans trans women and girls from women's and girls' sports at public schools across all age levels. And a challenge to a similar law in West Virginia brought by the mother of a teenage girl who wanted to play on her middle school's sports teams. The court's ruling means those laws and similar laws in 25 other states will be allowed to stand. And this could embolden the Republican Party to continue to push back on rights for transgender people. Last year, Trump directed federal agencies to withdraw funding from schools that allowed trans athletes in women's and girls' sports. And finally, the court struck down longtime federal limits on the amount of money that political party committees can spend in coordination with federal candidates. The decision is expected to give political parties more power. It will allow candidates to outsource major expenditures, including advertising, to national party committees in down-ballot races, taking on a more national tone, and may aid Republicans in their big RNC war chests in November's midterm elections. Today's rulings mark the official end to the court's term. Their decisions have dealt some serious blows and delivered several wins to Trump's agenda. Now, to Gideon with a closer look at the impact of one big win for Trump at the court yesterday.
Sticking with the Supreme Court, let's take a closer look at the impact of a standout win for Trump yesterday.
It has long been a goal of conservatives to put the executive branch directly under the control of the president.
Julian Mark is a Supreme Court reporter for The Washington Post.
Trump and the people that are in his administration believe that really simply that the president should just have control over what they identify as this regulatory apparatus.
Many of these bodies hold real power and can be a check against corruption or corporate interests. like the FCC, which regulates broadcasters, or the Securities and Exchange Commission, which works to prevent market manipulation. The Trump administration argued that it had a Democratic mandate to manage the leadership of the federal bureaucracy as the president saw fit.
One thing that can be frustrating for any president is that when they get into office, they have to sort of deal with these quasi-independent agencies that can be enacting policies that don't necessarily align with their agenda. I mean, that's pretty much as a part of their design.
The conservative majority argued that the Constitution gave the president the right to fire those agency heads, and congressional restrictions were contrary to the separation of powers. The liberal justices on the court took aim at that notion.
Well, the dissenting argument is that essentially this brings a lot of very consequential government bodies under the control of one person and their policies. And these agencies and these bodies, they control or they have impacts on almost every facet of American life.
Justice Sonia Sotomayor read the dissenting opinion from the bench, a sign of her strong disagreement with the court's ruling. She argued the status quo had been proven to work and warned that chaos will follow. Mark told us he thought disruption was certainly likely, but said immediate change was not a sure thing.
I think where Sotomayor's chaos prediction somewhat can be pushed back on is that the executive branch has a lot of agencies, say the EPA and others, that have just heads that lead these agencies and are subject to his whims. What makes it any different? And so I think that we have yet to see just exactly how big this will impact how the government works.
After yesterday's flurry of rulings, there remains one major caveat to all of this. The president cannot, justices ruled, fire governors at the Federal Reserve without cause, keeping Governor Lisa Cook in place after Trump's efforts to oust her.
The Fed, in its history and in its structure that Congress set up, is different, and it was meant to be independent of political influence. So essentially, the Supreme Court is kind of drawing this red line around the Fed as a sort of a special entity.
The Wall Street Journal notes that red line could give the new Fed chair, Kevin Warsh, freedom to act without fearing reprisal. The record-breaking heat wave in Europe is moving east, with Central Europe now facing sweltering and dangerous conditions. Forecasters project temperatures could start to ease across much of the continent in the coming days. But scientists are warning that Europeans need to prepare for more weather like this more often, because this heat wave is not an anomaly.
These extreme summers are just getting more frequent and getting more intense. The extremes are getting hotter, and the built environment was just not made with this in mind.
Joe Wirtz covers climate for Bloomberg and spoke to us from London. He's been reporting on why Europe is warming up twice as fast as the global average and the threat that that poses to people's health. According to the World Health Organization, over the last 4 years, there have been more than 200,000 heat-related deaths in Europe alone. Wirtz says that changing weather patterns are playing a role. So is climate change driven by human activity. And somewhat counterintuitively, efforts to reduce air pollution in Europe have also contributed, because polluted air can actually help deflect heat. And as Europe has gotten warmer, the amount of snow and ice blanketing the continent has dropped, which means that more heat is now absorbed by the ground.
It's worth knowing that Europe is not built with this type of heat in mind. The infrastructure, the buildings, the health apparatus just was never built with this conception of these types of summer extremes.
Much of Europe historically had a cooler climate, so the infrastructure was built to help retain heat during harsh winters, not release it. Air conditioning has gotten more popular in recent years, but 80% of homes across the continent still don't have AC, and it's not easy to retrofit many of Europe's buildings with it.
It's hard to sleep. It's hard to cool down. No air is cool. There's no relief in sight.
The heat is putting stress on the healthcare system and transportation systems. Trains have been canceled because the tracks are buckling. Asphalt roads are melting. And power grids are under pressure because nuclear facilities have been forced to stop or slow down operations. The very water they use to keep reactors cool is getting too hot.
That leads to energy cost increases and spikes. In some cases, we've seen prices hit levels we haven't seen since the energy crisis. The other thing to keep in mind is that energy costs in a lot of places in Europe are significantly higher than they are in a lot of other places in the world. Just the cost to run, say, an air conditioning, if you have it, are much more expensive than they are in other places.
Meanwhile, here in the U.S., forecasters are watching a separate heat dome expected to arrive this week that could push temperatures from Texas to New York close to 100 degrees. Health experts are warning that the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo could rival the largest on record. More than 1,000 people have been infected and hundreds have died. In recent days, the American CDC raised its response to the highest level, effectively an internal signal that controlling the outbreak is a top priority. The Trump administration asked Congress to approve $1.4 billion in funding to help combat the spread, and it also extended travel restrictions. Officials in the DRC, meanwhile, announced a ban on public gatherings in the country's capital. This Ebola strain, known as Bundibugyo, has proved especially hard to contain. But as Wired's Isabella Ward told us, there's actually a very promising option to treat it that's been sitting on the shelf for 15 years.
It showed 100% protection, and the monkeys that had been vaccinated, they showed no symptoms, remained completely healthy, while most of their unvaccinated companions sadly eventually died.
The vaccine also showed promising results when tested on monkeys after they were exposed to the Bundibugyo strain.
It protected 5 out of 6 of them. And that's a really important part of this because it helps you curb virus transmission. If you can vaccinate people who've been in contact with a case and trust that the vaccine will be able to fight off the virus before these people start developing symptoms.
But after that, the research slowed because Ward says at the time, there was not enough money or enough will to get this vaccine to human trials and to market.
When we think about who funds vaccines, it's either private industry or it's the public sector, right? Now, to industry, Ebola outbreaks are unpredictable, and they've typically affected countries in Africa with low purchasing power. So the pharmaceutical companies don't see themselves sufficiently profiting from a vaccine. As for government and charitable funding, there are a lot of infectious diseases in the world and a finite amount of money, of people with sufficient expertise, and of physical laboratories. And at that time, in 2011, Bundibugyo had only caused one outbreak, and it looked a little less dangerous than other strains. So within this already limited pool of resource, it just wasn't a priority.
But now that this outbreak is on pace to rival the largest on record, scientists are racing to catch up.
I think now they just are all sort of rooting, even for other universities, other teams, because they just want any vaccine to be able to work to curb the outbreak and the suffering we're seeing going on in Central Africa right now.
The solution won't be as simple as plucking this old vaccine off the shelf, dusting it off, and getting it to human trials. The process of running those trials and manufacturing the vaccine en masse could take months at minimum to complete. And it's possible the outbreak is contained by then.
But even if that is the case, they hope that this research will be valuable so that the next time Bundibugyo rears its ugly head, they're not caught on the back foot again.
Reuters reported that as of last week, the U.S. is beginning to work on a plan to identify viable vaccine candidates. Here are a few other stories we're following today. Another prominent NBA player has been implicated in an alleged gambling scheme. Malik Beasley, a three-point sharpshooter who recently played for the Detroit Pistons, allegedly manipulated his performance in a number of games during the 2023-24 season. He did it in order to make money for a former teammate and his associates. That's according to a federal indictment announced on Monday. The indictment follows another high-profile incident in which a player removed himself from a game with a fake injury in order to help gamblers make money. According to The Athletic, 5 current and former NBA players have now been indicted by federal prosecutors as part of a broad investigation into sports gambling. The knockout stage of the World Cup is already delivering drama. Paraguay stunned the crowds with a win against 4-time winners Germany. The game went all the way to penalties, and the smart money would have been on the Germans, who until now have never lost a World Cup shootout. And there was drama in Brazil versus Japan, too. Japan actually took an early 1-0 lead before Brazil got an equalizer. Then, in the very last minute of the game, Gabriel Martinelli broke the hearts of millions to squeeze in a winner.
Oh, and here's a chance. Martinelli! Brazil have won it! They've stolen it right at the death! Brazil are going through!
Paraguay and Brazil will find out who they will face next in today's games. And finally, they've been training for months, crafting their looks, and learning obscure facts for tourists. They are Philadelphia's Ben Franklin's, Betsy Ross's, and John Adams's. And as the Philadelphia Inquirer so beautifully puts it, this week's 250th anniversary celebrations are their Super Bowl. These trained historical reenactors have already begun a series of performances in Philadelphia's historical district and beyond. But they're expecting a huge flock of visitors throughout the summer. Before actors hit the streets for this tough work, they celebrate what they call the completion of their Benstitute training, which left one of the many John Adamses feeling elated.
It feels good. I feel better than I did at my college graduation. You know, I feel really prepared. I feel really excited, I think is the main thing. They've done such a good job of not just getting us ready to do this work, but getting everyone on board with it.
These actors have to be ready for everything, from staying hydrated in petticoats to guiding people to the best spot for cheesesteaks, all while using appropriate vernacular for the time. You can find all these stories and more in the Apple News app. And if you're already listening to the News app right now, we've got a narrated article coming up next. The New Yorker takes a deep dive into the world of repo men and how business is booming as Americans struggle with $1.7 trillion in auto loan debt. If you're listening in the podcast app, you can follow Apple News Plus Narrated to find that story. And we'll be back with the news tomorrow.